So welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 6. Before we begin, let's not forget that we are living and working on Tsleil-Waututh, the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Tsleil-Waututh people. It's pretty clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today our guest on Food Conversations is someone who has become, because of her assiduous personal efforts, the face of climate action in Salmon Arm area. Julia Beattie retired from a 30-year career as a biologist and then conceived and developed a significant non-profit organization. She is the founder and chair of the Shuswap Climate Action Society, which is, and I quote from their website, a non-profit, non-partisan group of volunteers and concerned citizens providing information and community support for climate action in the Shuswap and North Okanagan. Now, Julie and I are going to talk about the reciprocal relationship between a heating planet and the growing of food. Welcome, Julia, to Food Conversations.
Thank you, and glad to be here this morning.
Well, we're very glad to have you here because you're going to help a lot of listeners understand some things that are really important for all of us to be knowing about. Now, we're going to talk a little bit more about how you got to the place you're in now. But first, why don't we plunge a little bit into some science-y stuff? Most people now recognize that we're facing a global crisis caused by a warming planet. But could you give sort of a brief elevator pitch on what the crisis is, the climate crisis is, and why it's a crisis?
Yeah, no problem. We are changing our climate, heating up the globe as a result primarily of burning fossil fuels. There are other sources of greenhouse gases, and there are a number of greenhouse gases, but the most important is probably carbon dioxide. And it acts to form a blanket around the Earth so that when the sun's rays hit the Earth's surface, the carbon dioxide holds the heat, the radiant heat, in and starts warming the globe, water, land, everything. And that has really started to accelerate very rapidly since the Industrial Revolution.
And that's the key point, the speed of which the temperature's changing. The planet's been hotter and colder in the past, but it's never, according to the historical and the geological and geophysical record, it's never heated up this quickly in a couple of generations shooting up.
That's right. The rate of heating is unprecedented. And again, related to human activities and again, primarily fossil fuel burning.
And there's people who say, and I think they fall into category of climate deniers, say, well, it's just weather. It's just weather changes. How wrong could they be? Could you outline how wrong they are?
Yeah, no problem. There is a real big difference between what we see daily as our weather, what we recognize as weather, and the global climate. Global climate is long-term weather patterns. So indeed, it's a long-term average, as opposed to what we see every day, which is our weather. So big difference.
But we have a difference in that the events of weather now are intensified. It's changed fairly radically in that respect.
Absolutely. We are seeing all kinds of heat-driven changes, drought in some areas, floods in other areas, or drought followed by floods,
yes.
Wildfires. Of course, you know, this summer was a really excellent example of that here in the Shuswap because, you know, we saw long-term drought. The lake level was lowest on record, and we saw extraordinary tracts of wildfire forests being burned here in BC.
Now, there's a couple of words that people use. Sometimes they're not understood by the people who are listening to them, and they are, the words are mitigation and adaptation. So maybe you, as a 30-year career scientist, can explain the difference between those two.
Sure. Mitigation is when we do something to stop emissions, specifically related to greenhouse gas, global warming. Adaptation is things that we do to try and adapt to the situation that is changing. So that's the big difference. Mitigation I see as doing something to stop emissions, and adaptation is doing something to allow us to live through the changes that we are generating.
In medical terms, I think we'd call it prevention and treatment.
Yes.
And most people would say, I'd rather not have a disease at all than I'd have like to have a disease and have somebody make it all better, because that's much less pleasant. Now, it's becoming clear that the fossil fuel industry, that's oil, gas, and coal, we're fully aware of the fact that the trends that we're seeing today were coming as early as the early 1980s. They were starting to, among themselves, discuss what's actually coming down. And I think that would be something that we're all wrestling with now, the fact that the industry knew and has actively gone in the opposite direction.
Yes, that's very true. And there was hints of that even a decade or more ago. But there's been investigations done, and actually a pretty good book written called The Petroleum Papers. And it actually documents the time frame and exactly what was done and by whom. So a good read if you're at all skeptical.
An enlightening read as well. Now, we're going to be talking about food and the relationship, the reciprocal relationship between food and climate, because one affects the other and vice versa. But maybe we should talk a little bit about the long and winding road, the classic long and winding road that led you to where you are now, actively pursuing this particular path. It all began in the Toronto East General Hospital, where you were born, but you moved to Lakefield, a little town north of Ottawa, and you told me it was a lovely natural setting, but I looked it up on old Wikipedia, and this is what Wikipedia had to say. Lakefield, Ontario is a small community known for its stunning natural beauty, a popular destination for outdoor enthusiasts and nature lovers. From its picturesque lakes and rivers to the lush forests and scenic trails, there is no shortage of things to see and do in this charming town of 18,000 in cottage country. Now, what do you remember of this glorious community?
Not really a lot. I was a toddler, actually, at the time. And so I have some memories, but they're just, you know, sort of, mm-hmm. I mean, I was like maybe two years old, three maybe.
And you heard about puppies.
Yes.
invading your space.
Yes. When I was a toddler, my mother would put me in the playpen outside, and we had a black lab. And she had a litter of puppies, and there's home movies of me sliding around in my playpen with a bunch of black lab puppies.
With loose bladders.
Yes. Yeah.
And there was a chicken experience.
Yes. One memory I do have, actually, is being in a barn with my sister and seeing chickens flying around. I guess we had just gone into a chicken barn and disturbed the chickens, and I think it probably stands out because I was maybe scared that the chickens were going to fly at me.
It wasn't an entirely pleasant experience.
No.
I remind listeners that I'm talking today with Julia Beatty, who is the chair of the Shuswap Climate Action Society. Now, you went off to Utah. Your father's work as a salesperson for a heavy industrial machinery took you off to Utah for a few years. Any recollections of the Utah world, or is that...
Yeah, actually, there's a couple things that actually stand out. Those, I think, were the years where there was a threat of nuclear war. And we had regular drills as kids in kindergarten and grade one, where we would have to hide under the desk and...
Duck and cover.
Yes, duck and cover.
What a futile, ridiculous thing.
Yes. And I also remember having to sing the national anthem with your hand over your heart. those kind of little things. Yeah.
You had never forgotten where your heart is since then.
No.
So you came back to Canada. And what was coming back to Canada like, and to sort of... a more natural place for you to be.
Yeah, good actually, because we were closer to family. My parents were relieved to be back in Canada. I don't think they were really all that keen on staying in Utah. And yeah, we then moved to Aurora, Ontario, and that's where I went to public school there, elementary school and high school for a while.
And there were some encounters with animals in the environment that became part of your stock in trade. I'm holding up my hand with my fist clenched.
Yes.
Could you describe the meaning of this gesture?
Yes. I don't really have too many memories of this, but my mother told me when I was little, I would go outside and she would call me in for lunch, my sister and I, and I would be clenching my fist, holding something in my hand. And she'd say, "Julie, what have you got in your hand?" And I'd say, "My friends." And she'd say, "Well, let's see." And I'd open my hand and there'd be all kinds of bugs and whatever, creepy crawly that I could find. And she'd say, "Well, perhaps you could just leave your friends outside while we have lunch." So, anyway, yes.
And you did. And they enjoyed their lives and you enjoyed yours. Now, your mom was pretty calm in situations like this, but she wasn't always that way. It was sometimes a bit of a challenging relationship for you. You were the obstreperous child in her eyes.
Yes, I think so. Being the youngest, I think I was a little bit of a renegade, maybe.
Something that maybe equipped you well for later activities. High school, you said, was sort of, you played sports, you did standard kinds of things. And when you finished high school, you decided to go off. You went to York University.
I did. I went to York. It was close to home, and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do after
biology. You sort of wanted to do biology.
Yes. I went into a general BSc program at York. Actually, I tried 1 week. I did a year at university and then thought, well, maybe I'll be a vet technician. Went to a college for 1 week and went, this is not for me. So I went back to university.
Yeah. Parvovirus.
Oh, yes. So I actually decided if I was going to go into vet medicine, I would go to Guelph.
I mentioned parvovirus because you had a pretty challenging experience with in reference to veterinary medicine with respect to parvovirus. What was that like?
It was an experience that actually probably changed where I am today, for sure. A friend of mine who was at the University of Guelph worked at the clinic at the university, and the vet clinic, and took me on a tour. And it was full of dogs, young puppies who had parvovirus. And it was at the time.
It was a bit of an epidemic at the time.
Yes, it was. And these puppies were really quite sick. And I actually left in tears because it was just so moving and emotional for me.
Yeah, it's a challenging thing to see animals suffering when you can't help them.
Yeah.
You can't do anything much about it.
Yeah.
When you had that experience and you made that decision, you ended up going into marine biology. What was the biological field is very broad. What was it that attracted you to that notion, the concept of marine biology?
Well, I think, many young people dream of being a marine biologist and chasing whales and, you know, having a great career in research. And I think that's what drove me to getting a degree in marine biology.
And I think at one point you told me you actually did get onto a research vessel on the open seas.
Yes, I did, much later in my career. But so at the University of Guelph, they actually send you out to the East Coast for a practicum. And that was like, it really sort of solidified in my mind that I had done the right thing. Yeah.
And then you'd spend a lot of work later on land.
Well, actually both, because when I worked in the Skeena office for the Ministry of Environment, we did a lot of coastal work, the pulp mills and all that kind of stuff. So, so I got a real blend of experience.
Now, classically, you also had a time when you did a lot of other jobs that had nothing to do with being a marine biologist, working in restaurants. Worked at a racetrack because there were horses. By the way, we must mention horses because that's been a feature of your life. When did horses come into your life?
Before I can even remember. As long as I can remember, I've been like I was a horse crazy girl.
What is it about horses? Because it's obviously a special species for you.
Yeah.
What is it about horses that is so attractive?
Oh, you know, I really can't put my finger on it. They're extraordinary animals, and they're just wonderful to be around. I even like the smell of them.
Well, it's a very distinctive smell, and I think a lot of people like it too, yes. Anyway, you did eventually get a job that was at least modestly related to your learning experience at university. A friend of you said there was a job in waste management.
Yeah, so environmental protection, which is part of the ministry, at that time was called waste management. And it was, I guess, a fairly new ministry. I think it was established in 1971 in BC. And a friend of mine said, hey, they're hiring down at the waste management office in Surrey. So, of course, I went down there, filled in an application, and they gave me a job right on the spot.
Isn't it interesting? You got a job in a newly formed department called Waste Management. The fact that it's newly formed sort of implies we didn't care much about what happened to what stuff we threw out. And we called it waste. And then as time went on, there was an awareness that it's what we're doing to the environment with our waste that needs to be addressed, not how do we pile it up in heaps and divide it among different sites and all that kind of stuff. It's an interesting linguistic progression from no department to waste management to environmental protection. And you were in at the beginning of it almost.
Yeah, not right at the beginning, but certainly, you know, the work that we did in the environmental section, it changed over the years a lot. It progressed as our understanding of impacts progressed. We had a lot more techniques, you know, at the end of my career than we had at the beginning of my career. So it was a really interesting field, and I loved my job.
And you would prepare reports for the engineering department, and engineers tend to have a pretty cut-and-dried approach to what they do, and you would be telling them, well, maybe this is good, maybe that isn't so good. But you found them not unduly unsympathetic. They would pay attention to what you would say.
Yeah, they would for the most part. I mean, we worked as a team, typically. And so there was, for the most part, a real mutual respect. Mm. We had input into how the permits were generated, what kind of restrictions, limitations on emissions or discharges, and monitoring programs.
But it would be very difficult to shut a project right down. Most of them were just modified.
Yes, to try and protect the environment, yeah.
Now, you did also, in your workplace there, have a really challenging experience. Your boss made some sexual sort of overtures to you. It wasn't overly invasive, but it was clear-cut what was happening, and it was right out of line. And at that point, even the union didn't have much of a mechanism for addressing things like this.
Yeah, this was like, back in the 80s, and there, I don't think at the time there was any language in the collective agreement on harassment, and certainly not sexual harassment. But, you know, I mean, it happens. It continues to happen.
Indeed it does.
In the workplace. And I don't think I'm unusual in having those kinds of things occur.
No,
when
sadly,
you're
not. It's not a unique experience.
Yeah.
And because there was no real remedy, the only really valid option that you could identify was just to leave your job.
Yeah, I took a one-year secondment to move offices and work for Fish and Wildlife for a year. But after the secondment was over, I had the option of going back to my job or quitting, and I decided I would quit and go on my own.
But at that point, a fortuitous experience took place, and that's when you met your future husband, Colin, in Smithers.
Yes.
And he's still around. We're happy to see.
He is.
And he's an excellent jazz pianist.
Yes, and a fisheries biologist, too.
There we are.
So there you go, the bio nerds.
Yes, indeed. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Julia Beattie, who is the chair of the Shuswap Climate Action Society. So then you started to, this was the beginning of your real sort of career at this point, getting into the long-term employment with the government.
Yeah, so I was employed, I guess in 77 I started a job up in the Smithers office, and we covered the Skeena region, which incorporated also the marine waters.
So let's talk a little bit about the process that you would have gone through. Somebody, a proponent, comes forward with a project. Were you the first line of defense for the environment?
Not necessarily. It was usually the engineers that dealt directly with the permittee. We might be included in meetings with a potential permittee. You know, we would see mining proposals. We would weigh in on those or other, you know, industrial or municipal discharges. I mean, we looked at everything. And we even covered agricultural waste complaints, which was under the umbrella of our regulations. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you, you were working embedded in a bureaucracy, and for a young woman who's been a wild child in her early years, what was it like working within the constraints of a substantive government department?
You know, it wasn't bad, really. We had our colleagues in various offices doing similar jobs at the time. And we networked quite a bit and learned from one another. We used to have annual meetings together and share our information. And so it was pretty collegial. And within the Waste Management Branch or Environmental Protection Division, it was usually pretty collegial. And
So it was a kind of a community, really,
yes.
A community of people working together.
Yeah.
You also were encouraged, and perhaps you were even paid to go off and do extra training and learning experiences. What kind of stuff did you do? I mean, the choices you would have made at that point would have been choices that you presumably could have some say in.
Right. Well, as a professional biologist, there is a requirement to do a certain number of hours of professional development. So, but I did go back to university and take a couple of university courses just to improve my understanding. And also I wanted to be certified as a professional agrologist so that it broadened my aspects with employment.
So did you become a registered
I did, yeah. So I was a PAG and a RP Bio. And then later I became a qualified environmental professional, QEP.
Yes, we can talk about that in a moment. That's,
sure.
That's a sort of a sad tale, the whole QEP.
Yeah.
Yes. All the way along, were there horses in your life?
Pretty much, yeah.
So what do you do in Smithers? You ride off in the bush?
I used to ride the neighbor's horse, and then finally bought my own first horse. And
what was that like?
That was amazing. Cute little mare. And after that, we continued to have horses up until recently.
So. Yeah, I think it's perhaps a valuable experience for any person to have a close relationship with another species. It kind of changes our perspective about how the world works.
Yeah.
And how animals and consciousness works. What was in the work you were doing, what was the kind of relationship, the overall relationship you had with the natural world? I'm saying that because you were dealing essentially with an interface between human society and all the other species on the planet, particularly those associated with marine environments. What was the sort of atmosphere obviously different, as different people had different ways of looking at it, but what was the kind of overall atmosphere between you and the world you were examining and trying to protect, but also the world of humans that was saying, well, we want to build this and we want to make money out of that?
It could be very difficult. I got to say that you'd see the whole spectrum of, destruction to the environment. I'll use the coal mining in the East Kootenai as an example, where they literally take down mountains and make new ones of waste rock. And the scope of that, the vastness of that was jaw-dropping, actually. And, you know, it's still a problem today. And there's a lot of liability there.
There's a bit of an illusion in people's minds about British Columbia that it's kind of the wild frontier and it's all natural and pristine and we don't have to worry about protecting it. But that nothing could be farther from the truth than that in reality.
In some locations, that is true. So we need to value the areas that are still pristine. And old growth logging, for example, is something that we need to really preserve.
Absolutely. Now, you, after a long career and lots of experiences in the biological realm, you decided to retire. You'd retired a few years before the mandatory 65, or did you? Was it right on the nose?
I was 56, and at the time, you had to have a combination of years of service and age that added up to 85. So I was very lucky to retire at 56.
So we retired because, did you have to retire at that time or could you stay on?
I could have stayed on, but I decided to retire because my husband had been retired for a few years and was poking me in the side saying, come on.
Where are you? Yeah. I can't find you.
Yeah.
When you retired, you spent 1 year, if I recall correctly, with your QEP designation.
I did some contract work for the ministry for about a year and a half or so, and then decided to get my QEP designation and hang out my shingle.
Now, why don't you just... I think people in Salmon Arm know a bit about QEPs because there was a big project in this town on the delta of the Salmon River that was approved by QEPs, Qualified Environmental Professionals, who worked for a very large company called Stantec, and whose initial assessment of the delta was highly inaccurate, but fairly typical for the kinds of assessments that you're expected to do when you play that role, because you're hired by the company that wants to do the development. What was that like for you to be on the short end of the stick, as it were, after being a regulator for many years?
I think I went in optimistic and naive and from a regulatory background and being the kind of person that I am, under the regulation, it's pretty prescriptive, and there are certain things you must do under the Riparian Area Protection Regulation. And, I would have people contact me about doing some assessments for them. And after a conversation, it was quickly evident that I was not going to be greasing the skids for a project that, without having a fully... adequate assessment completed.
So what kind of, if you can maybe think of any example of the kinds of propositions that would be brought to you and the questions you would be asked that would clearly tell you that you are on a different wavelength from the person, the proponent?
Yeah. So I had one gentleman contact me and ask me to come and approve cutting some trees down. And I said, well, I am a QEP, but that is not my area of expertise. You have to contact an arborist who is also a qualified QEP. And I tried to explain to him that if I did such an assessment for him, I would basically be in violation of my own ethics, my own professional ethics that, you know, requires that, and in violation of the regulation. I wasn't qualified to do that kind of assessment. And he pressed me a little bit and then finally gave up.
So he would, but there were projects that came along that you knew were not going to be doing well with respect to the regulations.
Anything close to water would be closely scrutinized, and that's why they were coming to me for an assessment. But, you know, it was, I guess, in just a few conversations or email exchanges, it was clear that I was by the book, let's put it that way. And that's not what they were really looking for.
What were they really looking for then? Because this is an issue that has faced many people and this part of the world. It's a central issue sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think they were looking for a contractor that would literally grease the skids for their work, their project.
Yeah.
And I just was not willing to go that route.
The QEP designation is part of a broader program called Professional Reliance Model. The Professional Reliance Model means that proponents have a professional who they hire who decides if something's acceptable or not. What do you think about the model? That's a leading question.
Yeah. Having worked in a regulatory environment, I think that it is highly flawed. Because there is a lot of, how can I put this?
He who pays the piper calls the tune.
Yes, exactly. It puts you in a conflict of interest situation as a professional. And, you know, I just, also talking with other professionals, I understand that that's exactly how it can go.
Yeah, well, so. Certainly that's what happened in Salmon Arm. The QEPs who were involved with the Smart Centers project did shade their opinions, in fact, made significant errors in their assessment that favored the developer, Smart Centers. And I think we saw it up front, up close and personal when that was going on. And it ended up being part of an ombudsperson's report, the fact that the riparian areas regulation were just not adequate the way they were set up because they were being sidestepped so often. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Julia Beattie, who's the chair of the Shuswap Climate Action Society. So after you had a year as a consultant and faced this wall of proponents who were not particularly interested in what you had to say, you started to branch out and get into the non-governmental world, and partly because of an election, the federal election in 2019, when it was clear that the political leaders of the country were not paying a lot of attention to environmental issues. And this, what people are now calling the poly crisis, you know, not just the climate, but pollution and species extinction and a number of other things. And you got involved with the Green Party. What was that like?
It was actually a lot of fun. I was a volunteer, basically delivering lawn signs to people and just getting to know other like-minded folks. So it was a good experience. I've never really been active in politics, so... So,
but you were active in the groundwork, the ground level of the political world at this point. How was it different from being part of a fairly collegial, fairly well-defined bureaucratic community? What was it like to be out free living in the community?
It was really good. I think I learned a lot, certainly about how politics works. I still have lots to learn, obviously, but it was a really kind of good experience, a really fun experience, and it was a lot more, fulfilling than in some ways.
Why was it more fulfilling? What made it seem like you were getting somewhere, as it were?
I think it's because you can express your deeper feelings about protecting the environment, which is, you know, obviously my focus. And so that was, I think, often in government, you're not invited to speak so freely.
Yeah, that appears to be the case. I will echo that sentiment. What about the meeting? You had a meeting at your house. You invited people to come, and a number of people did come. And you started to hatch plots.
So this was post-election. And in that particular federal election, I had already helped to do a town hall here in Salmon Arm that May on the Green New Deal with Sarah Weaver and Neil Caves, a couple of really terrific people. And it was really well attended here in Salmon Arm, held here at the church. And then I organized a climate march in September of 2019 before the election. And that was really well attended. And it sort of gave me hope that there was enough people engaged in the issue of climate change and doing something about it, that after the election and meeting all these like-minded folks, I said, hey, how about we get together and talk about keeping the momentum going?
Forming an organization.
Yeah. And at the time, there wasn't an organization solely focused here in Salmon Arm on climate change.
Shuswap Climate Challenge. That was the first name.
Yes.
And then you changed it to the Shuswap Climate Action. And then you became a society, a registered society, became official.
Yes.
And now it's the Shuswap Climate Action Society in 2022.
Yes.
Yeah. What was that progression like to see it sort of gelling and becoming more formal and more focused and that kind of thing?
Oh, it was a steep learning curve, really. all of these people are volunteers, all of them typically quite busy. And so it grew slowly. And the one thing that we did try and get off the ground was in March of 2020, think back, what was occurring at that time.
There was an event going on.
There was.
An ongoing event.
So it
starts with C.
Yes. We
C-O-V-I-D.
Had,
anybody got that?
Yeah. So we had a meeting, and we were putting together a one-day seminar that we were going to have speakers on all a range of topics. And we were getting, names and people saying, yes, we'll be there, we can do this. And then on that same night, March 22nd, there was an announcement that there was a pandemic, or March 11th or something. I think it was March 11th. And it was like, oh, now what? Back to the drawing board. We've got this group. We're all ready to, pull
expand
the trigger
and
on.
Multiply, yes.
Yeah. And then now what? We can't have meetings. We can't, So we had to really change our focus.
You went digital.
We went fully digital. We started a website. We were on social media. We started a newsletter.
Webinars.
We established a Zoom account. Since then, we've been doing webinars. We've solicited articles from local community members, all on our website.
Talk to political representatives.
Yes.
An exciting experience sometimes.
Yeah, we did speak with our MP. We've spoken with our MLA a couple of times. Yeah, trying to get active.
You were also a member of the Environmental Advisory Committee, mm-hmm. which I was also on, and I think when somebody comes in and says, I've had a 30-year career as a biologist on a committee like that, it immediately attracts attention. We have a professional forester who's still on it, I believe, and it was part of a process of giving some sort of experiential and educational muscle to a body that was advisory, but nevertheless had enough insights in its membership that it could really actually start to shape behavior. We'll talk about that a little bit more, about the shaping of behavior. Now, earlier in the show today, I asked you about the difference between mitigation and adaptation. And I think it's time for us, since this is a food show, to talk about climate and food production, the growing of food, because there is this reciprocal relationship. How you grow food has an influence on the climate, and what happens to the climate has an influence on how you grow food. It was an excellent presentation, by the way, for listeners who would like to see what was happening there. The event is recorded on the Shuswap Food Action Society and is available on the Shuswap Food Action Society's website. Is it on your website, by the way?
No, but it should be.
It should be. You heard that first on this channel. Yeah, it was.
This was at the Fall Fair.
Yeah, at the Fall Fair. It was part of a long couple of days where many presentations took place. This one was a little unique because it drew together two parts of our, critical parts of our experience that are often considered separately, but of course they are closely intersecting. So let's even just talk about some of the things that came up then, because we reviewed the intersection between climate and growing food and preparing food in considerable detail, and it was focused on solutions, mm-hmm. not on just defining the problem. Now, we've already talked about what the climate crisis really is, so perhaps we could talk about the solutions that we explored. Now, the first was about how agriculture happens and the conventional method, which is heavily involving agrochemicals, involving large monocultural plots, and that kind of thing, is increasingly challenged. Organic regenerative agriculture. Why don't you talk about that a little bit and why it's relevant for the climate?
Right. Well, industrial agriculture, also called conventional agriculture, is very destructive. And as you mentioned, it uses a lot of chemicals, fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers, and
many
pesticides.
Of which are made out of petroleum.
Yes, yeah. And pesticides, and many of which are also made from fossil fuels. Yeah. And that's proven to be really not yielding the kind and the nutritious kind of clean food that we need to sustain our communities.
And farming in what's called a regenerative way often involves greater carbon sequestration. In other words, carbon is kept in the soil rather than burnt off or otherwise put out into the ecosystem.
Yes, that's right. So no-till farming, cover crops, things like diversifying the kinds of plants that you're growing on fields, also integrating your livestock with your other farming. A teaspoon of soil apparently contains billions of microorganisms, and those seem to be the lifeblood of the soil and also sequesters a heck of a lot of carbon dioxide.
It's interesting. People are just starting to understand that our bodies are a huge mountain of organisms, that what you brought into the kitchen to show your mother when you were a child is a tiny fraction of what is actually in our bodies all the time. They're much smaller, but they're there all the time. Let's think a little bit about how food is brought to the table and the whole notion of relocalizing food. I think that's a very important thing with respect to the climate. Food miles. Why don't you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, I think that this is, there was, you know, the 100-mile diet and all of those kinds of initiatives that were talked about, you know, and have been talked about for a couple decades now, I think.
Indeed.
And those are an effort to bring attention to your community that you've got to start buying local. It supports local farmers. Local agriculture makes us more resilient. It's an adaptive approach to, instead of focusing on foods that are trucked in from other parts of the world.
By machines that produce a lot of greenhouse gases.
Yes. Let's focus on making our own communities more food resilient and sustainable. And I think also a good example of where that really broke down was when they had the floods in the fall of 2021.
21, yes.
And all of a sudden, shelves were empty here. And that is a really excellent example of how it can go badly sideways if we don't have local food supply readily available, if we don't start changing our preferences in the grocery stores. And it's really a big thing.
Which leads directly to what kinds of foods we eat, and eating, the notion of eating lower on the food chain, as people are now starting to understand, is a really important principle. Because the amount of greenhouse gas production and energy consumption of different kinds of foods is really quite dramatically different from one food to another.
Oh, it is, yes, including water consumption. Eating less meat, eating more plant-based foods, and eating local and organic, all good things to keep in mind. I know, you know, even years ago, there was the Meatless Monday initiative, and we've adopted that in our household. We don't eat red meat. We eat some chicken, some fish, but we don't eat it all the time. And I'm trying to learn how to cook more vegetarian meals.
Well, my wife has demonstrated that that's quite easy to do, and it really does make a difference when you turn that way. Now let's talk about a project that's related to all this, and that's called the Lose the Lawn Project. Lose the Lawn.
Yes. Something that we have found out is quite popular. we engaged. Actually, I should a shout out to the city of Salmon Arm. We went to the city and asked them if they would help support us and fund the contract work that we have from the two people who've helped us with the presentations, and they generously did agree to that. So it really fits in with their water conservation strategy, and so that was a good fit for them and for us.
Things like Xeriscapes.
Yes. So we've got two presenters. One is a permaculture expert. She's done work in the city here, and she's a local gal, Kelly Westgate. She's the owner of Lecker Land Design.
Indeed.
And she's actually helped us rewild our own backyard. And the other gal is Sigrid Kendrick. She's the executive director of the Okanagan Xeriscape Association. Well educated in plants and xeriscaping in the Kelowna area primarily.
Lawns are also a place where a lot of water goes, and where pesticide use, especially by homeowners, is often dramatically heavier than it is in agriculture, because agriculture knows that people are going to eat the flowers and not just look at them. And that brings up another aspect of this relationship between climate and food, and that is that because there are unpredictable weather conditions more and more prominent these days, growing different foods, which you mentioned earlier, and in different ways, is becoming something that is an adaptive process and also good for local food. So greenhouses, stuff like that. How would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, this summer, and well, actually the past several summers, has given us a good idea of, you know, how we must find different ways to grow food. In our backyard, in our veggie garden this summer, we had to provide shade because it was just too hot and too dry. Mm. And so, you know, mulching your garden, raised beds can provide an opportunity to, you know, and some of the techniques, permaculture techniques that are being employed.
And having a few trees.
Or having more trees, please. And this not only addresses just, you know, your own personal food production and local food production, it addresses the biodiversity crisis that we are currently in. We're losing insects and birds and pollinators at an extraordinary rate. And this, the diversity in your backyard allows for more diversity of critters in your backyard, and that can only help us.
And it is, it will help us. We know, because lots of evidence shows that insects play an incredibly important role. We tend to think of them as annoyances because we remember the mosquitoes and flies, but in fact they are doing a lot of work for us that isn't being done as well now because of what we've been doing. Now, the ultimate process is to go to policymakers and start talking to them and saying, we think you should change direction in certain areas. Things like water restrictions, things like encouraging composting at a municipal level, tree protection. By the way, the city of San Norman has just passed a bylaw which has strengthened tree protection. That's part of what needs to happen too.
Yes. Our group was involved in recommending changes to the previous tree removal bylaw, and now will be called the tree protection bylaw. One of our members, Frederick Vroom, an urban forester, forestry expert, was involved in providing recommendations to that bylaw update. And these are really important things that we have to go to our municipal leaders, our federal and provincial leaders, and demand change, demand the kinds of things that are going to help our communities be more resilient.
And speed up what they're doing, too. Not just drag their feet and say, well, when we've got a massive consensus, then we'll go ahead, but acting earlier.
You know, we keep hearing from various research groups. The UN just released their emissions gap report 2023, and it is, again, a call to action for everyone to do more, do it quickly, and we've got to bend that emissions curve down as quickly as we can. Otherwise, there will be catastrophic impacts that we're going to be suffering through.
And one of the things that leads to better decision-making is collaboration between people who are experts and people who are living their lives. And that's something that, having worked in the government, and if I use the word silo, you don't think of a farmer with a bunch of corn piled up in a tall building. You think of government departments that are working separate from one another and don't talk to each other. The process of, as we kind of reaching the end of the show, it's probably worth you sharing with us where and how you think we're doing, whether things are moving quickly in the right direction, how much foot dragging there is.
I think there's far too much foot dragging, and I think that there are far too many politicians who are saying one thing and doing another. They're saying the right things, but not necessarily following through with action.
Greenwashing.
Yes. And that's, and you know, there's a whole, you know, sort of populist movement that is, I think, interfering with real action on these really critical issues.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are depressed, or at least pessimistic, in spite of wanting to be optimistic. Just a final word on how you maintain a sense of optimism in the face of what we're agreeing is a foot-dragging process.
I think when I look around at the resources, the natural resources that we have, I want to do everything I can to preserve them, to enhance them. And I think that gives me the hope to keep going. Plus, I'm kind of a stubborn person, maybe. And maybe that's my Irish background. I don't know.
I think a little stubbornness goes a long way. It's like salt on your food.
Yeah.
Makes it taste better.
Well, I think, you know, I am ultimately an optimist, but I think there's lots that can be done. Come and join our group. for instance.
There you are. You have your invitation, listeners, to join the Shuswap Climate Action Society, and you've heard Julia outline what it's accomplished and the direction it's moving in, and I can only say it's the direction that I think most thoughtful people would agree is the right direction. I want to thank you, Julia. Julia Beatty, the chair of the Shuswap Climate Action Society, for joining us today and showing pretty clearly that you can't talk about climate and food as separate issues because they're pretty closely linked. And I thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.